The interesting thing about the UK election was that it's technically speaking the most undemocratic election ever in the UK's history.
Because explain.
Hi, Mark. Good morning.
Good morning to you down there in the Cape, which is bringing its weather to us. Now, I know we've been told not to talk about weather, sport, or politics on this podcast. So I'm going to propose 20 minutes of silence, okay? Because that's the only damn thing that you see in the news. You know, I'm so over Election 24 as being the dominating news thing. Do you understand all of this left, right, center? Are the definitions of political persuasion still coherent, relevant, and generally understood? You're an expert on these things, man. European politics and what. What's going on, Tim? I don't understand any of it anymore. Okay.
By expert, I think what you mean is, yes, I have read the Financial Times.
Well, there we go. You're way ahead of the average, yeah, because
I know.
You can read for meaning and be, yeah.
It's so interesting because both the British election and the French election were supposed to demarcate shifts to the right.
Yeah.
The French election especially, I mean, everybody knew that Labour was going to win the British election. The question was just by how much.
Yeah.
But still, there was some interesting stuff happening on the right and in the UK too. But both the elections seem to indicate a shift to the left, because far from winning the most number of seats in the French Parliament, the French right wing got the fewest out of the big three parties. And the Labour got exactly what it was supposed to get. But the interesting thing about the UK election was that it's technically speaking the most undemocratic election ever in the UK's history.
Because explain.
Well, if you have a first-past-the-post system, it's possible to have more seats than your proportional vote.
Right.
So Labour got just over 40% of the vote, and it got well over 60% of the seats.
Yeah.
That difference between the two is the largest that it's ever been.
Yeah.
In the French case, the French elections, I have to say, I'm very impressed. I've never really thought about the French system. You know, they have a two-stage system, and the smaller parties get knocked out. So only the bigger parties go through to the second round. But then if you have that system, there's a kind of natural inclination for the centrist parties to dominate.
They have an eliminator, right? And then they have the game, the main game. It's a bit...
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, I think that's kind of interesting because it certainly won't result in, you know, the GNU. Or it might result
strangely in... Strangely enough, it has, in fact, resulted in the GNU.
A real GNU.
Exactly. The French have also got a GNU now, or they're also going to have a GNU.
Everyone is adopting the GNU as their national animal from henceforth. Forever. Okay. Because that's the only. I sort of have my academic studies were centered around statistics. And there used to be a very old fashioned thing called the normal distribution.
Okay. Right.
Now, the normal distribution says that, you know, the average people are all cluttered around the middle, and then the extremists are on the left and right. That's what it says. It says there are very few people way over there and way over there, and standard deviations right now. Now, I don't think that the normal distribution remains the go-to checkpoint for statistics, for risk, for life assurance, for all of these things, because we now live, it seems to me, in what is properly described as a bimodal distribution, where you've got a whole pile of people on one side and a whole pile of people on the other side, to be academically precise. Okay. And so what does that bring forth? So you've got, it seems to me that the center comes about as we compromise. The center, it seems to me, is never elected anymore. There isn't consensus. In fact, I'd go further. I'd say, and this might be twisting the English, but there's no more common sense. Have I got that, Tim? I mean, there's no more, conventional wisdom. There's no more.
Yes.
These are outdated concepts, and people are dissatisfied with the status quo from whatever angle they've chosen to see it. And so everyone's voting for something different. And that parts us. It doesn't combine us. And then we come together because we have to.
Yeah. I've always said that, you know, you should look into politics in not in a two-dimensional way, but at least in a four-dimensional way, at the very least. So a two-dimensional way would be left and right.
Yeah.
But if you think about it, just to take the most extreme examples, Just take the right, for example. You have Hitler, the most idiosyncratic right-wing leader in history, and Margaret Thatcher, also right-wing. You think they, you know, you consider them both right-wing. But actually, Margaret Thatcher was right-wing libertarian, and Hitler was right-wing authoritarian.
Yeah.
So if you had a second dimension to your political analysis, you would have left-right, libertarian, authoritarian. And you could do that on the left too. The Chinese Communist Party, left-wing, authoritarian, and the British Labour Party, you could say, or whatever, you know, would be more left-wing, libertarian. But, you know, I don't think that even applies very much anymore. Do you like that idea or not?
I get that idea, but, you know, what's the consequence of that? The consequence is that you have to get a label to get voted for. Okay, you have to label yourself. You have to gather with others and speak the speak of that particular focal point or, you know, ideology in order to get into parliament so that you can represent the people. But you have to, at least in some way, adjust your speech to get a vote, it seems to me. So you get nowhere as an independent mind. Okay, independent minds are over. Okay, what we need is populism, populism, populism. And that in a bimodal distribution doesn't make sense, and it doesn't give a good result. It gives you a lowest common denominator compromise, and you have to go down to a level where enough people believe your bullshit for you to reign over them. I mean, I've had it with this stuff.
You know, the problem is that political systems have never been more complicated than they are now. Strangely enough, when you had a bipolar world, a left and right world, when you had, you know, America and Russia, you know, on the poles, it was actually much easier because you had these two dominant forces. All the other groups defined themselves in terms of those two poles. But now we have, you know, bipolar, quadrupolar, quintupolar world. It's more difficult.
We also have, with all of its pluses and minuses, information today. You know, you turn 18 or whatever you turn to vote, and you are flooded with information that as an 18-year-old, I didn't have sight of. You know, there was almost generational voting adherence, but there isn't anymore. And so the needs of the population, the varied needs, you know, by any demographic, be it age or race or religion or whatever other divider, let me call them, are very different. And so you need to position yourself where you aggregate the biggest set of common causes in order to get in. And I've lost faith in it, Tim. You know, no one seems to focus on what is required for us to meet all of the demands of all of our peoples, and that is got to be founded in economics. But I don't hear economics as a driver. I hear it as a sort of a belated
ticket box. Good point. Yeah.
And so no one goes, like, okay, this is fabulous. How are we going to get there? You know, and it's populism. That's all it is. It's how many people can you persuade? And there's more unanimity in sports functions than there is in parliament. I mean, I don't know. I went to Loftus Versfeld this weekend to watch the Springboks give the Irish a bit of a lesson. Although I have to say, we got the rubber, the green. We got the close calls that helped us a bit. But we sang our national anthem, as diverse as it is in its coming together. And it was overwhelmingly wonderful. And there wasn't an ounce of ill will in the stadium. Why? Because we had common purpose. Now, politics, it seems to me, is defined by the absence of common purpose and, you know, divisory manifestos that preach. Tim, I'm finished with this politics thing, man. Help me.
This is the other thing that I was listening to. You know, people are coming up with great phrases, of course, these days. And one was, you know, the old Abraham Lincoln phrase, you can fool some of the people all of the time and you can fool all of the people some of the time. So the new thing is, yeah, that was true then. Now you can, in fact, fool all the people all the time.
The evidence supports your contention. Yes. And you know whose fault is Tim, it's your fault. And you know why it's your fault?
No, I know, I know. It's the media.
Because you're a fan of AI, okay?
No. I wanted to make a different point. Obviously, I don't want to focus on that so much. The other point that I sort of keep on making is that, you know, people use politics, I think, these days as part of their, you know, identity and their conversation. But actually, it doesn't matter as much as it used to. And in fact, you can see that very obviously in the economics, because almost all around the world now, the state constitutes between 20 and 30% of the economy. But it demands, you know, 90% of people's time and interest, or maybe it doesn't, you know, maybe people actually don't care that much. But if you look at the column inches that are spent on politics, it's definitely, you know, a head and shoulders more than the rest of the economy put together.
Yeah.
So, you know, and that's actually where the action is happening. That's where the important things are taking place. That's where innovation comes about. That's where wealth and
progress,
the distribution of, you know, progress happens.
Yeah.
It's not in the expenditure side of the economy. It's in the accumulation side of the economy.
Yeah, but the trouble is to have a sensible discussion about economics and the drivers of economics and, you know, and economic models and the formation of capital and things of these nature, you have to have some knowledge.
Okay.
It's based on, it's actually based on facts, you know, and things which one can prove and disprove. And so that is not, you know, popular speak. First of all, you know, the general population are not invited into such debates. And the debates themselves are had between people not qualified in these criteria, in my current view of what's on offer in politics here, in the US, in Europe, anywhere you like. So how do we change it? And will it change itself? What will be the end game here, Tim? Will politics become less and less relevant? Or will we develop parallel universes to cope with, you know, different aspirations and fears?
I think politics becomes less and less relevant. Maybe that's just, you know, my sort of own personal bias kicking in.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you look at the world now and see all of the functions that used to be performed by governments that are now not being performed by governments, the incursion of the private sector, not just in South Africa, you know, there's big complaints about the private sector being, you know, sort of dominant in government, but internationally, the pinnacle of this is that it was always considered absolutely impossible for any institution other than a government to have a space program.
Yeah.
And now, by far, by a country mile, the biggest entity that actually shoots rockets up into the sky is a private entity. It's amazing.
Yeah.
And by the way, it's not just in, everyone knows about SpaceX, but, you know, there's a private entity in China that's doing it. There's a very successful New Zealand private space program. The Jeff Bezos space program is getting underway, and it's taking a long time, but it's definitely on the cards. So, you know, if you just look at that and all of the rest, you know, the airplanes, for example, was always considered that as, you know, serious nations have flag carriers. The whole,
yeah.
almost no country owns its flag carrier anymore. No government owns its flag carrier. Well, that's not quite true, but, you know.
The big question emerging out of that, is that good or bad?
Okay.
You know, now there's a big debate about, you know, privatization and all those good things. Is it good or bad? And why do I ask that? Because so many people talk to me when I was involved in civil servants, you know, about private sector can do this better and private sector can do that better and all of that. And I don't think that's universally true. First of all, and second of all, for how many people can the private sector do it better? Okay. And so, yeah, you can privatize everything, but who would that serve? What percentage of the population would that serve? And so there's this debate, there's this parallel need for, you know, both of which are need to be supported by commercial sustainability, but there's this parallel, you know, need for commercial prosperity and developmental necessity, if I could classify those things as that. And that's where the state does have a role to play. The second point I want to make is it brings into focus what has really happened at Eskom in the last, you know, we've had 100 days or whatever you want to measure it of no load shedding. And there's been lots of debate. I mean, the cynics, and there are many amongst us, go, oh, they're just burning extra diesel. And then something comes out which says, no, that's not true. And then it seems to me that the solution has somewhere come out of the liberalization of energy provision, you know, and solar and all of those private sector initiatives. So there's 800 megawatt things that have come out of private sector, and that the mines aren't flourishing and working hard. And so, you know, what is the true explanation of that split of effort? And does that sometimes evade us in our analysis?
No. I think, you know, Eskom's such a great example of exactly this debate because, you know, truly you want everybody in the country to have access to electricity.
Yes.
It's such a baseline need.
Yeah.
So you don't necessarily want a situation in which the private sector is the only dominant player here. But you also don't want, you know, South Africa's sort of gone to the situation where if you have a dysfunctional state enterprise, then really the private sector has no option but to take up the you know, pick up the slack. You know, there ought to be a scientific way to try and assess who does what best. You know, what proportion of taxpayers' cash do we need to fund electricity for basically everybody outside of the middle class? You know what I mean? Outside the 6 million people or whatever it is who form part of the South African middle class, purely for that. I mean, these things, I do have faith in the long-term efficacy of being flexible and gradually working your way through this. You know, there's that great saying by one of the Chinese leaders, I forget his name, you know, he said the way to cross a river is to put your foot forward and to take a step and then another step. And you know, you feel your way forward.
I think an open mind, but it requires an extraordinary leadership for that to prevail as the model, because that open mind must permit necessity and yet manage, you know, shortage and all of those kinds of things. So, it does come down to leadership and how you can do this stuff and make it work as a mix. And of course, there must be a mix, but you sort of got to pay your way. And you cannot create dependency in the process. You have to create a groundswell of economic opportunity in order for this thing to be sustainable.
Yeah. It's a strange thing because we should just clarify for readers, we have two facts out this morning. One of which is that Eskom is going to lose around about 15 billion rand.
15 billion, yeah.
This year. And that's mainly because the fuel bill was around about 30 billion. The total year's fuel was estimated to be about 30 billion. So, you know, there has been, you know, quite a lot of usage of the peak power plants. And the second thing we've got is that our new electricity minister is still keen to build another nuclear plant the size of Coburg. So, you know, after how many years are we, you know, going to sort of chase this mirage? It's just incredible. I mean, it's technically possible, but it does mean that, you know, all of the other big expended items of government would have to be put on hold. You know, and they're not going to do that. They're not going to put NHI on hold in order so that we can have another nuclear plant. I'm sorry, it's just not going to happen.
I'm sorry, but these things beggar understanding. Okay, I mean, I read this 15 billion number somewhere, and in the same sentence almost, it was like we're going to lose 15 billion this year, but we expect to be profitable next year. Now, I'm sorry, but someone would have to show me how that's vaguely possible, okay? And particularly if you're now going to go into another CapEx program. So it does go to the, you know, what qualifies you to pass judgment over these things? And there's been enough written about the qualification, experience, leadership qualities, and, you know, and track record of ministers in different boxes and things. I'm over that debate because I guess it's just another measurement that I'm not familiar with that entitles these things. I've got a number, Tim.
Okay.
Okay.
Hit us.
I was watching one of those TikTok things about, you know, the development of the speed of cars. And the fastest car now, I mean, the slowest car used to be able to walk past it. But the fastest car is now a Bugatti something or other, which goes at 420 kilometers an hour. Okay. And my only observation about that is, may fuck modelist. Okay, I mean, you know, I would hate to see the consequences of that going wrong. So, you know, that's what I've got for this week, huh?
Good.
And we got to mention it. I know we don't like to, but how's the weather down there in the crew, my friend? Because it's coming frozen. Our way. It's frozen.
That is my number of the week is I'm frozen, and it's going to be frozen tomorrow, and there's going to be more freezing.
We'd like people to complete the sentence for us. It's as cold as...
Okay, that's a good one.
Hardly. Do you know what comes out of it? As my cold, we keep warm, people. Keep warm and safe.
Cool. Likewise.